Hey everybody, welcome to the Damage Report. We both have channeled the spirit of John Iadarola.
Indeed, yes.
I'm Brett Ehrlich, that's Brooke Thomas.
Yes, hi, good morning.
How are you this morning?
You know, I'm here.
You're here. I would say the world is decidedly different today than it was yesterday.
Okay, why is
morning?
That?
Because yesterday morning, two things hadn't happened yet. One, it had not been debate season officially.
Right.
There had been no Democratic debates. And before yesterday, the gerrymander might have been made illegal. That thing is, that's different now. It has been made legal. I don't even want to tease it and be like, find out what happened to the gerrymander, because that is horrifying.
Right.
So we have a lot to get to today. I know I'm going to be presenting stories about the Supreme Court of the United States, those decisions I made. I will also be presenting some things about what happened during the debate. What are you going to be telling the folks about?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about a little bit what happened after the debate, and it got bizarre.
Yeah.
Kind of what happened, yeah, it was...
It was a strange days.
It was a strange day. We've got a couple cool interviews coming up for you too. We have Jamal Bowman, who is actually running for Congress in New York. And we have a story out of Alabama that is, I would say, a woman's worst fear, worst nightmare. Yeah, so we have a lot to talk about today. Should we get started?
Let's get started. John will be back tomorrow, by the way.
Yes, so don't fret.
Okay. Your country's different now than it was yesterday because the gerrymander has been okayed by the Supreme Court. The decision was handed down by the Roberts Court, and they essentially said, we conclude, according to Chief Justice John Roberts, that the partisan gerrymandering claims present political questions beyond the reach of the federal courts. Federal judges have no license to reallocate political power between two major political parties with no plausible grant of authority in the Constitution and no legal standards to limit and direct their decision. So basically, there's always these like caveats when it comes down to, I know there was a Supreme Court ruling. I know what they found, but why did they find it? Basically, John Roberts has had this this angle of saying, I don't want to be politically involved in voting, voting districting, all that kind of stuff, because he thinks that would be a political move. However, by stepping outside of all of this and saying it's okay, I definitely can't say anything about gerrymandering, he's essentially condoning gerrymandering. So that's it. So what do you think about this?
I think the idea that we have to find constitutional technicalities to rule it illegal to draw districts based on how you want the outcome to be.
Yeah.
Is wild for me.
Right. So essentially he's saying, I don't want to have anything to do with this, but like, I just want to give you guys an example of the kinds of processes.
And to find it illegal. Did I say that?
Yeah, to find the processes at work in order to draw these maps in the first place. Like just how politically motivated was, for example, North Carolina was one of these groups, was one of the states that had was in question. Here is Assemblyman David Lewis of North Carolina, who he said this during the process of drawing the districts. He said, I think electing Republicans is better than electing Democrats. So I drew this map to help foster what I think is better for the country. I propose that we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats.
And right there, I think electing Republicans is better than electing Democrats. Fine, you shouldn't draw maps.
Right, and so here's what's happening. This is the essence of this issue. Chief Justice Roberts said, I don't want to be involved because I don't think the judicial branch should be involved in drawing these things. It's a political discussion. He believes that there's like no explicit racial bias, which is what there is no explicit. Okay, sure. There's no one. He didn't say, I do not think that Republicans are better than Democrats and whites are better than blacks. But like, come on, man. That is very much in North Carolina's racial and political history.
Right. That's how it happens. If you look at these maps and how they've been changed, that's what they do. They don't even have to. They're not looking at who's voting what, and they're not going back in history. They're just looking at, where do all the black people live? How can we split them up so that their votes don't count as much?
Yes, exactly. And so If Chief Justice Roberts says, I'm not going to do it, then it falls on the legislatures, which we've shown explicitly have said that I have political bias, and which Brooke says and essentially effectively communicates is, come on, man, racial bias.
Yeah.
But here's how it plays out. Now that it's up to the legislatures, how are the legislatures ever going to change it if the effects of gerrymander are already in place? Mm-hmm. So here I'm going to give you a bunch of ways that while the people, the human beings who live in these states, the voters have said, this is how I want to be represented. And I'm going to prove that because of the gerrymander in all of these instances, their will has been utterly thwarted. And now the Chief Justice has made it explicitly the case that this will always continue. So in 2016, Republican congressional candidates won 53% of the statewide vote, okay? But as predicted, they again won 77% of the seats. So 53% of the people said, I want to be represented by Republicans, but 77% of the people are represented by Republicans. And so we're going to skip ahead to this graphic. This is not only in North Carolina. So we have this chart from the Washington Post, which shows in Pennsylvania, 54% of the people voted Democrat, but they only are represented by 45% of the seats. In Michigan, 53% of people voted Democrat, but Democrats still are in the minority in representation, 47%. North Carolina, 51% voted Democrat, 45. That's the difference between the state and, but this is for congressional seats in the 2018, congressional election. That is what's absolutely abhorrent. There is no mechanism in place anymore for the court system, which I think is implicit in the separation of powers. Court system needs to step in and be like, all right, that's messed up. And the lower courts in each of these situations, the federal district court in North Carolina said, no, this is messed up because of what you said.
Right, because states should not have a system to skew state legislatures. That just should be against the rules.
Yeah. I'm not going to read these graphics, but in Florida, the people after a public referendum, 2/3 of people said we should allow felons to be able to vote. And Ron DeSantis essentially just came back and said they're overturning that. In Maine, ranked choice voting, all the same. When people voice what they want for their states, time and time again, the legislatures who have been gerrymandered within an inch of their life have overturned the will of the people, and now there's no mechanism to stop that. Okay, there was another decision that was made, and we're gonna talk about that right now. The Supreme Court ruled on the census question, sort of. So before them was the decision whether they would allow Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, to add a citizenship question to the US Census, and here is the result. The US Supreme Court blocks Trump's census citizenship question for now, is how the headlines read. The US Supreme Court handed President Donald Trump a significant defeat on Thursday, ruling that his administration did not give an adequate explanation for its plan to include a contentious citizenship question. So basically they said, you wanna add a citizenship question? They gave a reason, being like, I wanna make it so minorities are protected, is literally there.
It was a blatant lie.
Yeah. Insane. And so even Justice Roberts was like, that's not enough. So they send it back down.
Yeah.
So more specifically, the explanation that they gave from the Chief Justice Roberts said the court cannot ignore the disconnect between the decision made and the explanation given. Neither respondents nor my colleagues have been able to identify any relevant, judicially manageable limits on the secretary's decision to put a core demographic question back on the census. I know I talked to someone who worked on the census, and they said already without a citizenship question, people are afraid to answer.
Right, absolutely.
Because they think, you know, the ICE is going to do a raid and kick them out, even if they're legal, and that has actually happened.
Right.
And so, I mean, what do you think about this?
I think it's surprising that Roberts made this decision, that went with this decision. I think that his hands were tied. I think that there was way too, first of all, their response to this, their reasoning for adding this question just didn't make sense. But also, gerrymandering doesn't make sense. It doesn't make legal sense for me. It doesn't make fair sense. It doesn't make just sense for me. So their reasoning behind the citizenship question didn't make sense to me. But I think it took the proof that was magically almost unhidden
Right. So that is the proof that you're talking about is there was
Hoffler.
Hoffler. Uh-huh. Yeah, Hoffler was a consultant for the Republicans, and his daughter found a bunch of thumb drives after he died that essentially exposed his nefarious intent in helping gerrymander people and basically underscored like the citizenship question and how it would help people. It would help the Republicans forever.
And some of his words were word for word in there were written, and it's what the Trump administration used word for word in their argument as to why this was an okay thing to do. So you couldn't even say that there was a disconnect between what he thought, what he was doing, and what they were doing because they were actually using his words.
Yes, absolutely.
Without changing a piece.
By the way, the Republican, this also was a North Carolina issue that came to the fore because that's where this all took place in. And the counter argument from the Republicans wasn't that the evidence is wrong. It's that, listen, you didn't find the evidence in the right way.
Right.
He died. You shouldn't be able to have access to it. But just one more thing. The census explicitly in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution says we're not counting citizens. We're apportioning money based on the number of people. So I'm going to read from the 14th Amendment. Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed. People try to turn that into, well, the illegal immigrants don't pay taxes. Yes, they do. And study after study shows that they put more into the system than they take out of it. So we got to take a break.
Yes.
But when we come back, we got a lot more for you. So don't go away. We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Hey there, welcome back. Here's a fascinating topic I feel like we can't ever find out enough about. Trump's money, his finances. And here to break down 9 things you need to know about Trump's finances is Center for Public Integrity's federal politics reporter, Letitia Beecham. Hey there, good morning, welcome.
Good morning, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here with us. So let's just break it down because you guys have a fascinating piece out. And I feel like there's not even enough time, there's not even enough space on the screen to talk about what we could know about Trump's finances, what we need to know, what he's potentially hiding from us. But I like that your piece begins with no presidential candidate's finances have ever been so complex and controversial. Yes, can you just break that down for our viewers?
Yes, because every day or every week, it seems like we are finding out something new about Trump. And compared to the other candidates that my colleagues and I have discussed here on the Damage Report, Trump is the one guy who doesn't really need much of an introduction. And to give you a context of how complicated and how successful he's doing right now, just this Tuesday here at his Trump International Hotel, which we reported in our piece, he makes tens of millions of dollars off of and where people go to actually influence the president and the administration, he raised $6 million in one night for his campaign. Now, mind you, Brooke, this is in addition to the $36 million that he has raised since officially announcing his candidacy just last week. So if you're Donald Trump right now, you're feeling pretty well. And more importantly, you're outraising all of the Democrats right now. And what are we at, number 24, 25 now?
Wow. And so that's a little bit about his hotel. That reminds me of his condos, because there's a kind of a fascinating breakdown that you guys kind of uncovered as to how he makes money off of those, right? You can talk a little bit about how they're purchased, how they're bought.
Right. So he has made money off the sale of about 1,300 condos. And the reason why that's important is because the purchases for these condos have been made through shell companies. And for those who aren't familiar with what that means, essentially, these are all cash payments and transactions, which means you're not really up for scrutiny from federal regulators. So the concern there with a lot of people is, what is he hiding? There's a lot of room for money laundering through having shell companies that are able to purchase and buy condos.
And what did we learn from Trump's latest personal finance disclosure?
Yes, we learned that, again, he is making tens of millions of dollars off of his Trump Hotel. And the reason why that's important is because, one, this is right next to the White House. I mean, not literally, but it's pretty close to the White House. And so you have all these foreign leaders coming in, trying to influence the president, and even people who are big names here in business here in America, they're using this hotel to not only make Trump rich, but also to potentially yield influence in this administration.
So, hi, this is Brett. The question I have is, so does this violate the emoluments clause? And is it still like shady and not certain? And what more do you need to find in order to prove that?
Right. So just Tuesday, a federal judge struck down Trump's appeal to try to get rid of this lawsuit that 200 Democratic senators and House members have launched against him. And that is the tricky question. That is the $100 million question, or billion-dollar question, if you are Trump, is whether or not this is legal right now. Because when it comes down to it, Trump's business transactions, especially with the hotel, especially with the money that he has in different accounts that are across the globe, essentially, he is still profiting while he is in office. And what these 200 Democrats are trying to get the Justice Department to do, which, mind you, is representing Trump, is to see whether or not he is violating the Emoluments Clause, which prevents a sitting president from being able to profit from foreign entities.
So just a follow up, like, I know you guys, as you said, have looked at every other candidate's finances. I guess, have you seen anything remotely like this from other people? And if not, why is the way this is different something I should care about? Like, what is it materially affecting that people should be concerned about?
Right. So the thing that is different from Trump is that, one, he does have a lot of wealth and he does have a lot of access. And what that means for the average everyday person is, well, is the person sitting in office, are the people in his administration? And I would like to remind everyone watching that this is probably the wealthiest cabinet that we've had. Are they putting the American people's interest at heart, or are they putting their financial interest at heart? And that really is something that the average citizen and the person who is going to vote pretty soon needs to consider.
Well, Letitia Beecham, federal politics reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me. Have a good one.
All right, we'll be right back. Still looking here. Sorry.
The first campaign presidential debate of the season went down in Orlando, and the first 10 candidates faced off. There was more to come today, but we picked the most momenty moments of that debate, which we will play para usted ahora mismo. Vale.
This economy has got to work for everyone. And right now we know that it isn't. And it's going to take all of us coming together to make sure that it does. Necesitamos incluir cada persona en el éxito de esta economía. Pero si queremos hacer eso, necesitamos incluir cada persona en nuestra democracia. Cada votante necesitamos la representación y cada voz necesitamos escuchar. Right now we have a system that favors those who can pay for access and outcomes.
I just can't. So what that was Beto O'Rourke, uh-huh. And what he was trying to do was communicate in Spanish some things about inclusivity in the economy. Did it play well or not?
Right. So last night immediately I thought, no, this didn't play well for me. It felt out of it just felt like pandering, like weird. Mm. And I actually don't mind pandering because I feel like sometimes that's all marginalized communities can get.
Right.
You know what I mean? But this morning I have a bit of a change of heart because someone on Twitter tweeted me and said, you know, my mother only speaks Spanish and moments like that make her feel included. And so I've got to respect that because there are a lot of people, I know Republicans are going to hate this, but there are a lot of people in this country who do not speak English.
Yeah. And I also, you know, kind of, it registered with me the Espanol that they were speaking.
Uh-huh, yes.
It also registered with Cory Booker, who this image of him reacting to it went viral. Of like, bro, what are you doing?
You know what? At first I thought it was, bro, what are you doing? And now I realize it was, dang it, I wanted to do that.
So he also did do it later on. And that's what I thought too, because it was circulating. And whether it was accurate that was what his reaction
yeah.
was or not,
it was
that Twitter
ways.
Community was like, I can't help but circulate this. But I think that's the face that Cory Booker makes when he goes into, okay, escúchate. Like listen really, really hard, because I also kind of speak Spanish. Okay, so moving on, that okay. happened. There was some talk of healthcare, and here is a specific moment when they asked people to raise their hand if they supported getting rid of private insurance. Here's who did that.
Many people watching at home have health insurance coverage through their employer. Who here would abolish their private health insurance in favor of a government-run plan? Just a show of hands, start off with. All right, well.
So that was Elizabeth Warren and Mayor de Blasio.
That was when the debate started.
Absolutely.
For me. We were watching it and it was like, okay, I'm up now, all right. Because the first question kind of became like this opening pitch for mm-hmm. everybody. And it was like, all right, we follow you on Twitter, got it, mm-hmm. had it.
Right.
But that was fascinating. And that was when de Blasio was kind of noticed, I think.
Yeah.
People were paying attention to him for the whole rest of the debate because of that, I think.
So this is very interesting uh-huh. because the question was worded as who's in favor of abolishing their private insurance for, which is a weird way to put it, for a public plan, essentially. And it was only Warren and de Blasio who raised their hand because Medicare for All has been such a hot button issue and almost a litmus test for people to say whether they're true progressives. And after all of the litmus test passers, these were the only two that raised their hand. So Elizabeth Warren was asked to explain herself. Here's the response.
I think of it this way. Who is this economy really working for? It's doing great for a thinner and thinner slice at the top. It's doing great for giant drug companies. It's just not doing great for people who are trying to get a prescription filled. I'm with Bernie on Medicare for All, and let me tell you why. I spent a big chunk of my life studying why families go broke. And one of the number one reasons is the cost of healthcare, medical bills. And that's not just for people who don't have insurance, it's for people who have insurance. Look at the business model of an insurance company. It's to bring in as many dollars as they can in premiums and to pay out as few dollars as possible for your health care. That leaves families with rising premiums, rising co-pays, and fighting with insurance companies to try to get the health care that their doctors say that they and their children need. Medicare for All solves that problem. And I understand there are a lot of politicians who say, oh, it's just not possible, we just can't do it. It's have a lot of political reasons for this. What they're really telling you is they just won't fight for it. Well, healthcare is a basic human right, and I will fight for basic human rights.
So there you go.
Yeah, I like that, and I liked the way the question was worded, because how does Medicare for All work if people don't give up their private insurance?
The counter argument, actually, if you want to hear it, here's Beto O'Rourke okay. giving his counter argument, and Mayor Bill de Blasio getting noticed.
Our plan says that if you're uninsured, we enroll you in Medicare. If you're insufficiently insured, you can't afford your premiums, we enroll you in Medicare. But if you're a member of a union that negotiated for a health care plan that you like because it works for
your
you and your family, you're able to keep it. We preserve choice by making sure that everybody has healthcare.
Time is up, Congressman, but I do want to ask a follow-up on this one. Just to be very clear, I'll give you 10 seconds. Would you replace private insurance?
No, I think that choice is fundamental
to our
ability to get everybody cared for.
Private insurance is not working for tens of millions of Americans. When you talk about the copays, the deductibles, the premiums, the out-of-pocket expenses, it's not working.
That's
How
right.
can you
so,
defend
so for
a
those
system
for whom
that's
it is
not
working?
Working,
they can choose Medicare. For the culinary workers in
you
Nevada who I listen
to, you've got to start by acknowledging the system is
for
not
those
working
plans,
for people.
They're able to keep them.
Why are you defending
Americans
private insurance?
Say they like their private health insurance, by the way. It should be noted that 100 million Americans. I mean, I think we should be the party that keeps what's working and fixes what's broken.
But that's not what you just said when you were asked to raise your hand. And this, I think that those two people raising their hand, they were saying, hey, I think every human in this country deserves the same level of health care as me. I don't think because I can afford it, I should have a different level of insurance than the poor's.
Right.
And we're not talking about the difference in being able to buy at Gucci and having to shop at Walmart. We're not talking about clothes. We're talking about health care.
Right. Right. So the counter argument that seems to be the one that has the most traction among the moderates is the union one, which says, listen, I'm a Democrat. Democrats typically advocate for unions. And I don't feel like I can go to the unions and say, listen, you have awesome union insurance, which will be better than anything else in the world. And I can't tell you to go for the Medicare system. But rather than say, I'm going to make Medicare up to that level at the very least, they're just afraid they're going to have a situation like Obama had when he said, if you want your doctor, you can keep it. He can't achieve that. And then he lets down people in their own from their own perspective.
But we fixed it. If you just delete it, it does fix it. Then the money all goes into Medicare.
Right, I get it. And I think my counter argument to the union thing is, listen, that's not all unions do.
Right.
And then we can free up unions if we take the burden away from the management who is saying, I need to pay, you know, there for a lot of people, the companies have to pay into a system, right? And this way, everybody would be paying into a public system. You don't have to negotiate for that stuff anymore. That's taken care of, and you can still advocate for better Medicare for all. But in the meantime, this then frees unions up to just say, okay, we took care of healthcare. Now let's advocate for higher wages. We can focus on just that.
Yeah.
Anyways. Do you want to do de Blasio?
Let's do it.
All right. So Mayor de Blasio had one way of distinguishing himself from everyone else on stage. Mm-hmm. Take a look.
Rachel, I am chief executive of the nation's largest city, and I also want to just say something quick on the gun issue and come to your question. Look, I run the largest police force in America, too, and if we're going to stop these shootings, we're going to get these guns off the street, we have to have a very different relationship between our police and our community. I also want to say there's something that sets me apart from all my colleagues running in this race, and that is for the last 21 years, I've been raising a black son in America. And I have had to have very, very serious talks with my son, Dante, about how to protect himself on the streets of our city and all over this country, including how to deal with the fact that he has to take special caution because there have been too many tragedies between our young men and our police, too, as we saw recently in Indiana.
Do you know Cory Booker has to take those same precautions?
But not in New York City, where the police are crazy. By the way, I run New York City.
Right. So I run this police force that is running wild. Haven't done anything about it. Also, Rikers is still the worst place you could ever end up. But instead of doing something about it, let me tell you how I talked to my son about how to protect himself from the police force I run.
Right, it's a weird pitch, which does make you feel like, did he just want to say he has a black son?
That's exactly, that was a talking point. And it was crazy and how he had the audacity to sit there and said, I have something that sets me apart from everyone here on this stage. There is a black person in my house. there's a black person standing right next to you who understands exactly what you're talking about and would and wishes that you do something about it. So he too would be safer in New York City. That was absurd.
Yeah.
And but also, you know what? It made a lot of people feel good. A lot of people bought it. It worked really? For a lot of people. It ignored marginalized communities, including the ones in his home. But it made a lot of people feel good. They were like, you know what? You're right. If he's president, he didn't do anything about it as mayor, but he's going to do something about it as president. What?
Mm-hmm. Good God.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we go on just a little bit? Or
yeah, let's keep going.
All right.
Keep going.
We're going to keep going because there were a lot of reactions. Lots of reactions to this Democratic debate. Specifically, your president, he had a couple bizarre reactions. Initially, while watching it, he said, it's boring. He tweeted, this is boring. That's it. That was his reaction.
Good analysis.
And it's just, this is the president of the United States. And then he had some fun, I guess you could say, with MSNBC in the second hour of this. They were having some technical difficulties, which is normal when you run a live show remotely. But the president had time to do this. Take a look.
Senator Warren, I want to start with you. We are less than 50 miles from Parkland, Florida, where 17 people were killed in a school shooting.
Someone's got my binder.
What's happening?
We are going to take a quick break.
We prepared for everything.
Guess what, guys? We are going to take a quick break. We're going to get this technical situation fixed. We'll be right back.
What?
What a sweetheart.
Well, he has too much time. You should be busy. Also, another person who should be busy, Meghan McCain. She actually tweeted out, and I think she deleted this, but she tweeted this. Take a look. It says, I know this isn't the point of a Democratic primary. Usually that's when you should stop and delete, but it's fine. She kept going and said, but there's not one person on this stage even making an attempt to reaching out at any Republican at all in any way. The absolute, and John pointed out how ridiculous it is that Republicans don't care about healthcare. They don't care about the economy. They don't care about foreign policy, all things that are discussed.
Right. So in every possible way, this was insane. This is like another version of Meghan McCain being like, can we talk about me?
Right.
My personal experience. And yeah, there were plenty of people. There's a spectrum of people talking about how to improve the healthcare system. Part of that spectrum is explicitly targeted toward people who are trying to be bipartisan. So they said bipartisanship. That is the defining difference between candidates in this debate, is the people who are strong progressives, people who are explicitly bipartisan, and all that. It's just very, very frustrating to watch.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to take a break and then we'll be right back. We have lots more for you here. All right, coming in live now, we have a Justice Dems congressional candidate. We have Jamal Bowman, excuse me. Good morning and thanks for being here with us. Good afternoon where you are, right? You're in New York?
Yes, good morning, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to have you here. And you are a middle school principal, Zara, is that right?
Yes,
that's correct. Fantastic. And you're running for Congress. And I know you've been on TYT shows before, but you haven't been on the Damage Report. So I want you to just break down for TDR viewers, you know, why are you running for Congress?
I've been in education for 20 years and I've worked in historically disenfranchised communities. So children and families who suffer from poverty, lack of health care, from asthma, from obesity, from living in food deserts. So I got to the point when I just became very frustrated with no one discussing the plight of our most needy families and children. Last year in the Bronx, we had children being murdered in classrooms, children committing suicide, and there was no national urgency and national emergency around these issues. So I want to bring an educator's perspective, a father's perspective, a school principal's perspective to Congress and begin to change the conversation around our most vulnerable people in this country, which are our children.
And as far as, you know, changing the conversation and protecting children, why does Elliot Engel need to go?
Well, he's been in office for over 30 years. He only about 9% of the people vote in primaries. So that tells me he's not present. He's not engaged. He votes for policies that have led to the privatization of public schools. He supports Wall Street. He supports private prisons, the crime bill. He voted for the war in Iraq. He voted against the Iran deal in the beginning. So he's more focused on the wealthy and corporations, and he's not as focused on the people as he needs to be.
All right, let's talk about your policies. Let's talk about the platform you're running on, because I know criminal justice reform is important to you. So I have a two-parter. One, as a New Yorker, I wanted to know your thoughts on Tiffany Caban winning. And two, what does criminal justice reform mean to you specifically?
So quite honestly, for me, we need to redesign our prison system as a learning system. What that means is when someone makes a mistake and commits a crime and unfortunately has to be put into prison, that person needs to be restored. It needs to be a space for restorative justice. So whatever academic, social, or technical skills that person does not have, they should be able to acquire them while in prison before they come out so they can contribute to society. In addition to that, I'm against, I want to ban the box. So when people come out of prison and not criminalized again and not able to find a job, I want to get rid of cash bail because I don't think you should be in jail because of poverty. I want to end solitary confinement. I want to separate violent offenders from non-violent offenders. The whole concept of putting anyone in a cage dehumanizes them, and I want to get rid of that completely. I also want to legalize marijuana. I think it's been over-stigmatized and it's been over-targeting of the black and brown community. I want to legalize it. I want to regulate it. I want to earn taxes from it. And I want to expunge the records of everyone that's been arrested for marijuana possession. And then everyone who's in jail for marijuana possession, and reinvest those funds back into the communities as part of a reparations model.
So, hi, this is Brett Ehrlich. My question for you is, there's a lot of people out there who don't live in that constituency, but they feel like they want to help. They're Justice Democrat supporters. After hearing you, they might be motivated to get involved. What's the best way that they can help you accomplish this goal of winning this seat?
Thank you. Please go to the website, bowmanforcongress.com. Click the volunteer button, click the donate button. Every dollar helps. We did great out the gate. After our launch, we raised about $70,000 within 48 hours. So we've been doing very well. But please keep that going, because that will help us to build out our team and begin door knocking and engaging the community, because that's our strategy. We're not going to run TV ads. We're not going to do those things. We're going to go door to door, meeting the people in the community, learning from them, and listening to their issues. So please go to the website, bowmanforcongress.com, click the donate button, click the volunteer button, and help us out.
All right, and so I have to ask you about this, because this is something that everyone is thinking about and they want to know. If you were a congressperson right now, would impeachment be a top priority?
It has to be. President Trump has misled the American people. He's lied to the American people. The Mueller report clearly outlines that. And an impeachment inquiry needs to be opened immediately. Democrats in Congress need to do their jobs. They represent the American people. And we have to hold the integrity of that seat to the highest standard. And because of what he has done and how he has misled all of us, an impeachment inquiry needs to be opened immediately.
And can we talk about Medicare for All? Because last night on the debate, there were 10 candidates, 10 presidential candidates, and only two were willing to say they would get rid of their private insurance for Medicare for All. What are your thoughts on that?
Healthcare is a human right. Everyone in this country should have healthcare, period, end of story. I'm for Medicare for All. I'm for single-payer healthcare. It needs to happen. I couldn't believe only two people raised their hands. When you look at the VA hospital, when you look at Medicaid, when you look at Medicare, they all take care of our most vulnerable populations, which are the military, children, the poor and the elderly. And they're all very good. And they're all government-run and government-backed health insurance. So I support it 100%. And healthcare is a human right, just like housing is a human right, just like education is a human right, just like environmental justice is a human right, which is why we need to back the Green New Deal 100%. So I'm absolutely for Medicare for All, no question.
All right, Jamal Bowman, running for US Congress in New York's District 16. Thank you so much for being here with
us.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back with another story that should upset you. Stay tuned. Hey there, welcome back. A 27-year-old woman, this woman right there, she was charged in the shooting death of her fetus, although police admit she was not the person who fired the shot. All right, her name is Marche Jones, and she's from Birmingham. She was 5 months pregnant at the time, on December 4th specifically, when an argument broke out between her and another woman outside a Dollar General. Now, this was reported by AL.com, an Alabama publication you probably know of far too well by now. The fight, which police said, all right, was over the fetus's father. It led to 23-year-old Ebony Jameson to shoot Jones in the stomach. Now, the mother did survive the shooting, but it resulted in a miscarriage. And excuse me there, I probably should have said the pregnant woman survived the shooting, but it resulted in a miscarriage. And so you're probably asking what happened to the shooter, the person who fired the gun. Well, the shooter was charged with manslaughter, but a grand jury did not indict her. Instead, at the time, police alleged Jones started the argument and Jameson shot Jones in self-defense. Pleasant Grove Police Lieutenant Danny Reed told AL.com a grand jury would consider charges for the mother as well at that time. So they did not get the indictment for the shooter and decided to go after the mother, the pregnant woman instead. So Wednesday, a grand jury did indeed indict Jones on a manslaughter charge. She was being held Thursday on, I think it was a $50,000 bond at Jefferson County Jail in the area. And it's at this point not clear whether she has an attorney. Now, the lieutenant says, he went on to say, it was the mother of the child who initiated and continued the fight, which resulted in the death of her own unborn baby. So essentially saying she started an argument and then got shot. And so it's her fault that she got shot because she started an argument. Let me tell you what Amanda Reyes said. This is the executive director of the Yellow Hammer Fund, and that's part of a nationwide umbrella advocacy group, an abortion rights advocacy group. Saying the state of Alabama has proven yet again that the moment a person becomes pregnant, their sole responsibility is to produce a live, healthy baby, and that it considers any action a pregnant person takes that might impede in that live birth to be a criminal act. Continuing with, tomorrow it will be another black woman, maybe for having a drink while pregnant, and after that, another for not obtaining adequate prenatal care.
This, when I see stuff like this, I feel like it's the perfect storm for conservative zealots to go, oh, it's both someone with a gun using it, and I get to belittle women essentially. And it also signals to me just how hard and on how many fronts the other side is fighting. So you have to fight just as hard and definitely harder because they are going so invasively to for, they found this story, they found it. And they said, listen, I want to go all in on not just, they don't, I mean, everyone else would just recognize it's a terrible, horrible tragedy that befell people and leave it at that. She's been through a lot as a result of this. But the conservatives in Alabama just basically said, this is my opportunity to further make her life miserable and to forward this political agenda, which explicitly is intended to take rights away from women.
Absolutely. And I want to put this in comparison to something, felony murder laws, which are stupid oftentimes. But you are reasonably supposed to expect that if you and a bunch of people have guns and you break in somebody's home to rob them, that someone may get shot and killed. And I can understand that. You are not supposed to expect that when you start an argument with someone that they will shoot you.
Yeah.
That is not okay to put on her.
No, it's not okay to put on her. It's just one of those things where it's like, okay, I see the attempt at logic that they have. But when it gets to a situation like this, instead of indicting her for manslaughter in this event, you should take a second, step back and say, oh my God, I've lost all touch with reality.
Right.
Because that's what I see when I look at something like this. This is someone who got in an argument at a Dollar General, got shot and lost her pregnancy. And as a result, she's been indicted for manslaughter.
And the person who shot her is free.
And that's it. And they just go to every extent to protect what they say are gun rights. No, right. It's not. And what they say is, you know, this crusade against, you know, killing babies, which is proven it's not. And that's already enshrined in the law, which accounts for the science you purport to advocate for. It is so insanely infuriating.
Right. And given their argument that this woman was having a baby, then she didn't. They don't care about her grieving process. It's just you started an argument. You deserve to get shot because you argued with somebody, which is essentially what they're saying. And the grand jury decided that that woman had the right to shoot somebody that made her mad.
Yep. And we'll see. I mean, everyone needs to stay glued to this story as more facts develop throughout. I want to thank everybody for watching. Brooke?
I agree. I want to thank them too. Yeah, this is always fun doing this with you.
I want to thank them a little bit more than Brooke does.
Okay, that's fine. We'll do that morning glory thing where we both fight over who gets to say bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.